Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Phyllis Bennis returns with more shrewd and sane insights about ending the many wars in Syria. I hope you'll stay tuned. Progressive author and activist Phyllis Bennis was in New England, October 13, 2016. She spoke at Emmanuel College in Boston. She spoke on her area of greatest expertise and greatest concern, U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. Her talk was titled, Ending the Many Wars in Syria. And we heard the first half of it last week. Last week, she focused on the complexity of the Syrian conflict. There's not a war in Syria, she says. There are at least a half dozen wars in Syria, half of them proxy wars. That is, wars actually between other countries, but being fought to the last Syrian. This week, Bennis continues. She refutes some of the myths Americans believe about the Syrian wars. The myth that the U.S. is not yet one of the belligerents in this conflict. The myth that our government is united in its opposition to Syria's President Assad. The myth that, under Assad, Syria's policies have been anti-American and anti-Israel. Quite the contrary. And she refutes the myth that imposing a no-fly zone is an alternative to war. In fact, it is an escalation of war. Then Bennis shifts gears and explores the staggering financial cost of America's undeclared war in Syria. Then she moves on to four good moves the United States government could make in Syria. Each of the four is likely to produce a better result than war. None of them is very likely to happen, though, especially not in an election year. That's Bennis's talk in a nutshell. But don't settle for the shell. Let's savor the rich stuff inside. Bennis is a fine speaker, a good scholar of Middle Eastern history, and seemingly a good person. I think it was Quintilian who defined the art of rhetoric as a good man speaking well. Except for the man part, that sounds much like Phyllis Bennis. Here she is again.
Now, there's a lot of mythology about the Syrian war. One is that the problem in Syria is that the U.S. isn't doing anything. The U.S. isn't intervening, and we need U.S. intervention. Well, it's a myth on a couple of fronts. Number one, the U.S. is right in there. The U.S. is bombing in eastern Syria. It's not bombing in Aleppo right now, which is very good because it would just be killing more people than the Russians and the Syrians are killing, and that's plenty. It's way too many already. But they are bombing, supposedly, against ISIS in eastern Syria. Now, the problem is what that means is, you know, you can't bomb terrorism. You can bomb people. You can bomb cities. Sometimes you can even bomb terrorists if you get lucky. But you can't bomb terrorism. And where ISIS is, there are people living there. They are living in cities. And the people in those cities have no ability to get out. So when we hear, and we hear this a lot about, we're getting ready for the attack on Mosul, we're getting ready for the attack on Raqqa. Those are the two kind of capitals of ISIS, Raqqa in Syria and Mosul in Iraq. Mosul is a city that once held about 2 million people. It now has, we think, somewhere around 675,000 people that are left. They can't get out. They can't get out. So when the U.S. starts to, quote, liberate Mosul with its bombers, ISIL will be able to get out. The people who live there will not. And that's who the people will be who will die. ISIS, I'm guessing, are going to get out, and they're going to scatter, and we're going to be hearing from them for a very long time. The same in Raqqa, inside of Syria. So one of the myths is the U.S. isn't doing anything, or it's not doing enough. Where people mean militarily. The U.S. isn't doing a lot of stuff it needs to do. But the military problem is not that it's doing not enough, it's that it's doing too much of the wrong things. So that's one of the myths. There's another myth that says that everybody in the U.S. wants to, in U.S. government wants to overthrow the regime in Syria. That's a myth also. There are plenty of people in power in Washington and some who are out of power, the neoconservatives and others, who have long wanted to get rid of the regime in Syria. It's one of the seven countries that were on the famous list that surfaced in 2002 that the neocons had been distributing about the seven countries they want to overthrow. That's certainly true. The myth is that that's the only reason that there's anything bad going on in Syria. You hear this from some. Not taking into account that Syrians themselves rose up against a pretty terrible government and tried to change it. The other problem with that analysis is that it doesn't take into account the reality of what the government in Syria has been about. There, one of the other myths is that the government in Syria, the Assad family, father and son, who've been in power since 1970, that they represent some kind of a center of resistance, an arc of resistance in the Middle East, that they are against the West, they're against Israel, they support the Palestinians, they're the real upholders of Arab nationalism. Well, it turns out, when you look at the history, not so much. It doesn't work that way so much. So you can start in from the time of the 1967, even before the Assad came to power, but certainly from then, Israel is occupying the Syrian Golan Heights, right? And the Syrian governments have made sure that the population was relatively quiescent, that the border stayed relatively quiet. Once in a while, there'd be a bit of a border skirmish, but those border skirmishes never really resulted in full-scale war. Fast forward to 1976, the Syrian regime, in support of a right-wing Israeli-backed militia in Lebanon, launch a massive attack against the Palestinian refugee camp at Tel Azatar, killing a huge number of Palestinians. So this notion that they're all in the interest of Israel, they're against Israel and supporting the Palestinians kind of falls by the wayside. 1990, the U.S. is running around, President Bush the first, trying to get support for the first attack on Iraq, right? Operation Desert Storm. They want a coalition that includes Arabs to give them credibility. So they go to Damascus and say, will you join our coalition? And the answer is, sure, no problem. So Syrian Air Force fighter jets, fighter bombers, are sent to participate in the U.S. coalition bombing Iraq in 1991. 2003, in the global war on terror, the U.S. goes to Syria and says, can we outsource interrogation to you for detainees that we're picking up in the global war on terror? You're so good at interrogation. And the Syrians say, sure, why not? So one of those people is the Canadian citizen Maher Arar, who's arrested at Kennedy Airport, interrogated for 3 weeks by U.S. and Canadian officials. They think he's a terrorist. He can't confess to anything because, what a surprise, he doesn't have anything to confess to. But instead of sending him home, they ship him off to Syria, where he is held for almost a year in a dungeon, a coffin-sized dungeon, and tortured for almost a year. The Syrians can't get him to confess to anything because, what a surprise, he's got nothing to confess to. He's finally sent back to Canada. The Canadians launch a big investigation to figure out maybe they did something wrong, and they determine, as a matter of fact, we did do something wrong. We identified the wrong person. He is absolutely exonerated. He is guilty of nothing. He is innocent, and they gave him $10 million in compensation for what he had suffered. The U.S. response, to this day, he is still on the no-entry list for the United States. My institute gave him one of our human rights awards, along with his lawyers from the Center for Constitutional Rights, back in 2006. And he couldn't come to Washington to accept the award. He had to do it by video because he's not allowed into the United States. That's the kinds of failures that are endemic to this so-called global war on terror. So what we're looking at now is a series of failures all around the region, calls to replicate some of those same failures. We're now hearing an escalating call for a no-fly zone in Syria. I always want to ask Secretary Clinton when she talks about it at the debates, so do you think that Secretary Gates was wrong when he said the first thing you have to do is go to war? Or are you saying you're fine with going to war explicitly against Syria, and now that means against Russia? Are you being really reckless, or do you really think he was wrong about this? You know, the problem is, there's another myth, that a no-fly zone sounds great. We need a no-fly zone where nobody is flying and nobody is dropping bombs. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about one side imposing a no-fly zone on the other and imposing it by bombing the planes or whatever that try to take off, who knows what. So it's a huge problem. It's not going to work. It's going to make everything worse. But it sounds like something you do by declaration. You know, you do it instead of bombing. Yay, a no-fly zone. Except that's not the military reality on the ground. So that's what we're facing. Now, I want to just talk about two more quick things and then open it up for discussion and whatever. The first is about the question of the domestic cost. You know, this is not only about how these things come back in what the CIA calls blowback, when an operation ends up biting you. You know, you get the consequences of it. One of the consequences of our global war on terror is that the U.S. is resented and hated in countries around the world for our bombing and killing people in those countries, for overthrowing governments that may have been very unpopular, but that local people don't necessarily think we should have had the right to overthrow, for all kinds of things. But there's also a very immediate economic cost. The current global war on terror, what President Obama calls the overseas contingency operation, is not nearly as expensive as the Iraq war under George Bush. That's true. We don't have 150,000 troops and another 100,000 U.S. contractors operating in Iraq, occupying the whole country. We have special forces, we have bombers, we have drones, we have all kinds of things. We don't have that. So the cost is not quite as much. But it's not chump change either. So when you think about this war that was started in 2014 against ISIS, that budget is kept completely separate from the Pentagon budget. You know, the Pentagon budget is its own thing. So the budget just for the war, just here in Massachusetts from 2014, you all, you taxpayers here, are paying $19,956 an hour, 24/7, for just that war against ISIS. And you've been paying it since August of 2014. That's a lot of money. Now, if you look at the Pentagon budget, the budget that doesn't include the war, doesn't include the nuclear weapons, they're in the Energy Department, doesn't include caring for veterans, only includes kind of keeping on the lights at the Pentagon, you know, keeping them in their bases around the world. Massachusetts taxpayers just this year are paying over $17 billion for that budget, for the Pentagon budget. Now, a billion, you know, you could say a gazillion and it would mean the same thing. I don't think anybody, are any of you math majors? No, okay. I'm not even sure if you were a math major you would know, but I certainly never really understood what a billion is, or even a million. I will tell you one story. When I was, I think, in second or third grade, I had a teacher who came in one day with this giant piece of graph paper. You know, the kind with the really tiny squares that were like 10 to the inch. And she put it up on the board, and it went like through the whole blackboard. And she said, all right, you kids, I want you to look at this, because all your life, you're going to grow up hearing about a million this and a million that, and you're never going to have seen a million anything. So here you are. This is a million little squares. Look at it and remember, that's how many there are. And there were a ton of them. And that was a million, not a billion. We're talking billions here. So imagine. But even my little square analogy doesn't really say what it is. So here's a couple of trade-offs. If you were not spending that money on the Pentagon, here's what you could do with that same $17 billion. You could pay for 171,450 elementary school teachers for a year. You could provide 231,333 clean energy jobs. What would that do to the unemployment rate here in Massachusetts? You could get 1.6 million kids into Head Start, or you could provide health care to 4.6 million children. Now, you don't have to worry about kids having health care because you live in a state that actually provides health care. What a concept. Maybe I should move here. But in general, you get the idea of what that money could be used for. What's going to keep us safer? Jobs and health and education, or more money for the Pentagon? You know, this is a huge problem. So the last thing I want to say, and then we'll open it up, is about what we can do instead. You know, it's fine to say the military stuff doesn't work. What do we do instead? So there's a few answers. None of them are easy. None of them are guaranteed to work right away. None of them will work in the short term. We know that. We also know that the military stuff doesn't work in the short term. So we have to keep that in mind. And only one of the four has any chance of being implemented in the near term. Having said that, I will tell you what the four things are. There's more, but this is a start. Number one, start with what every medical student learns on her first day of medical school, the Hippocratic Oath. First, do no harm. You know, they're taught when you have a patient, whatever else you do, don't make them sicker. If your goal is to stop ISIS or the Assad regime or Russia or whoever from killing people in Syria, stop killing people in Syria yourself. Pull out the troops, pull out the special forces, ground the bombers, bring them home, stop the military stuff. It's not doing anybody any good. It's making things worse and not better. You claim there's no boots on the ground, make it real. Get them out. And the sneakers, too, from the CIA and special forces. I don't think they wear boots. Number two, stop sending weapons to everybody and their brother who says they're fighting against ISIS or fighting against Assad or fighting whoever. This is the hardest one of all. Why? Because of the power of the military construct in this country. The people who make the bombs and build the planes and make the profits off of it, they're making a killing. So when you hear people say, well, no one wants this war, it's really not true. Most of us don't want this war. But there's a few people, very powerful people, who do. They're the ones who are making a profit off of it, who are selling the bombs and the planes and everything else to the Saudis and the Turks and the Jordanians and the Qataris and the UAE and everybody else, and sending them directly here too. It's not working. They all end up in the hands of the most extreme elements. So all this talk about, well, we're only sending it to the vetted, moderate, secular ones, you know, yeah, right, until they get run over by ISIS or whoever. Just stop doing that and move towards a full arms embargo. If we're serious about wanting the other side to stop arming the Syrian regime, for instance, you know, you hear U.S. officials saying, well, Russia and Iran must stop arming the Assad regime. Well, I agree with that. It's a terrible regime. They should stop arming them. But why do we think we have any credibility at all when we're sending arms to everybody else that's trying to overthrow the Assad regime? Who would listen to that? So it's got to be an arms embargo on all sides, and we can start that by stopping the arms shipments that's going to the rebels. Some of that's beginning to be talked about a little bit in the new pressure on Saudi Arabia that's happening in Washington. You know, the U.S. has sent, just under President Obama, $115 billion worth of weapons to Saudi Arabia, and they're using it illegally in Yemen and sending it off to be used illegally in Syria. This is a mess. Number three, we need new diplomacy, real diplomacy, and it's not going to be easy. Maybe something will happen on Saturday when there's this new diplomatic meeting that Secretary Kerry has called together. I'm not terribly optimistic, but that's worth hoping for at least. But we need real diplomacy that's aimed at ending the war and not just aimed at being more efficient in the bombing, which was one of the big problems in that last U.S.-Russia agreement that collapsed after about a week. It wasn't aimed at stopping the war. It was aimed at dividing one group of rebels from another so the U.S. and the Russians could go in together and bomb everybody. They want to bomb ISIS, they want to bomb Al-Qaeda, but they don't want to bomb the others. You know, this is not going to work. You can't have diplomacy that's aimed at better bombing and think that's going to lead to an end to the war. So we need real diplomacy that's aimed at ending the war. The fourth, and the only one that I think we might have a chance of getting somewhere soon, has to do with the humanitarian crisis. You all know some of the statistics. Half the population of Syria has been displaced from their homes in the last 5 years. 10 million of them. It's a number that's just staggering. Half, meaning it's actually a little more than half, about 6 million are displaced within Syria. 5.5 million or so are refugees outside of Syria, overwhelmingly in the countries surrounding Syria. There is a huge refugee crisis in places like Lebanon, where now one out of every three or four people in the country is a Syrian refugee. One quarter to one third of the population in the country. It's as if 150 million Canadians were somehow dropped in our shores with nothing but the shirt on their back, no food, no water, no education plans for their kids, no job, no nothing, and we suddenly are responsible for taking care of them. You know, that's the crisis in Lebanon. In Jordan, a country that doesn't have sufficient water for its own population, is now dealing with over 1 million Syrian refugees. This is a refugee crisis. Here, we don't have a refugee crisis here. We have a racism crisis here that's prohibiting more refugees from coming. And I've got to say, one of the outrages right now is to hear our government officials bragging, proud of our taking 10,000, a measly 10,000 refugees over an entire year, who have all spent about 2 years being vetted and another year before that in a refugee camp being vetted by the UN before they even get to the vetting process that we impose. And 78% of them are women and children. They're still taking 2 years or so to be vetted by the US. And we're proud of that? Germany last summer was taking twice that daily. And we're proud of taking 10,000 in a year. So we need a real campaign here to say we want Syrian refugees. Not because, well, don't worry, we'll make sure that it's only the good guys and we'll make sure they're safe. You know, it's because we want to welcome them. We're a country that claims to be based on refugees. You know, the give us your tired, your poor, unless they're Muslim or Arab. It's shocking. It's not maybe surprising, but it's shocking that our attitude has turned into such xenophobia and Islamophobia that's so bound up with this anti-refugee position. So we need a campaign to build support for refugees and build support for ending the war, not winning the war. Nobody's going to win this war. But we need a campaign that says we've got to end it. That means an arms embargo. Doesn't happen soon, but we got to start talking about it so eventually it will. Thank you.
On New World Notes, we've been listening to Phyllis Bennis speaking in Boston on ending the many wars in Syria. Thanks again to Dave Goodman of IBIS Radio, who made the original recording. I have edited out a stumble or two. The talk you heard was otherwise uncut. A few words from me, if you will forbear. 2016 is an election year, you may have noticed. And in this election year, as almost always, the two major party candidates have been trying to outdo each other in saber-rattling, in worship of soldiers and veterans, and in promises to further increase the already obscenely high levels of spending on the U.S. military machine. The United States has been at war in the Third World continuously for, I think, every day of my life, and I am 66 years old. Sometimes it's a big-ish war, as in Korea and later Vietnam. Sometimes it's been small wars, often three or four of them at once, such as now. In non-military terms, every war we have waged has ranged from counterproductive to a disaster. Even in military terms, every war has ranged from counterproductive to a disaster. With one military exception. One war was a good military success. That was our war against our evil enemy, Grenada. Our mighty, implacable, evil enemy, Grenada. Our proudest victory since VJ Day. October 25, 1983, our glorious war began. I will leave it to you to find Grenada on the map. If your eyesight is good enough and you have enough time, you probably can. But let us speak only of recent years. The U.S. invasion and bombing of Afghanistan, then Iraq, then Libya, proved three consecutive unmitigated disasters. Ongoing unmitigated disasters. Disasters not only to the poor people living there, but also to the world at large, including to the United States of America. So now, the war hawks are all shrieking to do it again in Syria. A long-standing, card-carrying, vociferous leader of the war hawks is our former senator and former Secretary of State, Hillary R. Clinton. Her Republican opponent has been a little less bellicose, particularly in matters involving Russia, which would include Syria. But Mr. Trump, too, is far more hawk than dove. That's how we used to talk back in the 60s. Hawks versus doves. Either way, no matter who wins, we can expect four more years of bloody warfare, leaving the world a more miserable and more dangerous place than it had been beforehand. which is quite an achievement. And good news for Lockheed Martin, as Bennis reminds us. As we're promoting regime change by bombing Damascus, will any of us reflect upon the disasters that followed this very same action we committed upon Libya, Iraq, Afghanistan? Probably not. The late Gore Vidal used to refer to this country as the United States of Amnesia. From darkest Connecticut, if memory serves, this is Kenneth Doust for New World Notes. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Thank you for listening. And speaking of amnesia, let's go out with a little music, an oldie by Midnight Oil. Illegitimi non carborundum, and ciao.
Conquistador of Mexico, the Zulu and the Navajo, the Belgians in the Congo, short memory. Plantation in Virginia, the Raj in British India, the deadline in South Africa, short memory. The story of El Salvador, the silence of Hiroshima, destruction of Cambodia, short memory. Hilton style, with running water specially bought, short memory. A smallish man, Afghanistan, a watchdog in a nervous land. They're only there to lend a hand, short memory. The friendly five, a dusty smile, wake up in sweat at dead of night. You're right.